And now reach out and grab the hand of that beautiful woman sitting next to you. If this is your first time at Grace, you don't have to interlock fingers. Y'all can sit down, except for Pam Hawkins. Pam Hawkins is one of my heroes of the faith, has been kind of a mentor for me from the cheap seats. So I want to ask you to pray for our time together this morning, Miss Pam.
So that we can worship you and praise you. We can pray for one another and love one another well. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lord, for calling Lisa Harper mm-hmm. into ministry. Thank you for how you have filled her.
Yes.
You have chosen her. You've used her to
yes.
your glory.
Yes.
For many, many years, Lord, we love to laugh with her mm-hmm. because she's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And she's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And she's so excited to be with Lord
mm-hmm.
because her love for you is thank you that you made her a mother.
Yeah.
That you called her to be the mother of Missy, that precious little girl from Haiti. Lord, what a joy it is to be a mother. There's nothing more exciting than being a mother than being a grandmother, Lord, because I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you for every mother in this room, every grandmother in this room. I thank you, Lord, that we can worship you today in this wonderful church that you called us to.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Thank you, sweet Pam. I didn't know you were going to sling that much sunshine my way. started to cry. I was like, no, not a eulogy, just a prayer. Way undeserved and so sweet. And I know all praise goes to Jesus, but I would be remiss if I did not say, I just think we have the best women's Bible study worship team on the planet. On the planet. Thank you, Faith. Thank y'all. I would probably get your name tattooed on my ankle if you weren't so stinking gorgeous. So that allows me to have just a little root of bitterness that they're so beautiful and so gifted. We are so excited to be with y'all this Christmas season. I just can't tell you how excited Alice and I get about getting to be here on Wednesday mornings. It's such a privilege, and I know y'all have a million other things to do. So we want to say thank you that you come here on Wednesday mornings. I want to start with a confession. Well, two confessions. One is, I know on this side you can see more than you really bargained for. And then on this side, my hole has remained intact. I got real animated during worship, and I broke the strings that hold this side of the poncho together. So I'm just wearing this ratty, almost see-through t-shirt because I didn't think it would show. So I'm sorry. This is going to be much more revealing than you expected Bible study to be this morning. Y'all are like the sheep. Y'all are the goats this morning because y'all get way more than you bargained for. Second confession. I brought Missy home from Haiti 2 years and 7 months and 3 days ago. And when I brought her home, I was told, you need to be real careful this first year and a half about how demonstrative you are. And they said, I went to an adoption transition specialist, spent good shoe money on that PhD. And she told me, Lisa, you just have to be really, really careful because when you bring them home that first year and a half, it is very easy to overwhelm them. And you'll actually, if you are too demonstrative at her birthday or at Christmas or with too many people in the house, it could actually set her back in her transition to your home from Haiti because Haiti was so stark and there was such scarcity. And so she especially counseled me, knowing that I'm a Christmas kind of girl. She said, don't do your normal Christmas. And my normal Christmas is somewhere between Clark Griswold and Mickey. I get really excited. I'm like, good night. How can a Christian not get excited at Christmas? And so it grieved me that first Christmas with Missy that I had to go real small. And so they said, don't do the huge electronic toys, you know, don't do all the lights. I used to do lights everywhere when I lived in Leaper's Fork. They were like, Lisa, don't do that. And so it just killed me, y'all, to leave all those lights in the totes. And I could tell it killed the farmer when I called him and canceled the pony order, but I did. And I just bought her a few little basic toys, and she was really happy. It was a really peaceful first Christmas. I bought her one of those real basic train sets because at the time she was enamored with trains. Just, I mean, it was just three little cars that went around this tiny oval. It was very, I mean, it was just, it was sad to me. It was very Dickens kind of Christmas because it was just so small. But last year I started counting. And last year, I counted and I was like, okay, April 14th, that's when I brought her home. April 14th, 2014. So I went May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. I was like, ooh, we're right past a year and a half. So last year, I bought her an Olympic-sized trampoline that will fit four people, and I made sure the weight would include me. And Christmas morning, I peed on her on the trampoline, and I also bought her a miniature Jeep and a house with a pool. And this year, she told me that she would really like to meet Mickey Mouse. And so we have tickets to Disney for Christmas, and we're staying in the Contemporary Resort, and she wanted bunk beds. And so they're on order, the bunk beds. And a friend of mine said this week, aren't you afraid of spoiling her at Christmas? And I said, no, I'm not afraid of it. That's the goal. This is my kid, and Christmas is going to be big at our house. And if any of you have a problem with that, I'm going to pray you get hives, because my kid didn't have Christmas the first 4 years. And it's all about Jesus, but we're making much of the first coming of Jesus in our house. And if Mickey doesn't sing a hymn, I'm punching Mickey in the throat, because this is all about Jesus. But it's big, y'all. It's a big Christmas. And I really felt last night as I was praying about today in my spirit that God was saying, I want my girls to have a big Christmas this year. I want my girls to really get me this year. I want my girls to celebrate in a way they haven't maybe celebrated Christmas in a long time in their spirit. So we're going to look at a different Christmas story this morning. Usually Luke is the Christmas story we find ourselves in, the birth narrative, because that's the lovely one. That's Bethlehem, that's the barn, that's the shepherd, that is the wise men. Matthew's Christmas story is not nearly as warm, not nearly as familiar. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. In other words, the birth of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob, and Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Hardward, and Hardward the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David, the king, and David was the father of Solomon, the wife of Uriah. I'm going to stop right there because I know y'all are so inspired. We could just kind of have a kumbaya and drink some spiced apple cider and we'd all be good, right? I mean, when you first read that Christmas story, it doesn't do much for your spirit, does it? You've got to kind of understand the context of this birth narrative in Matthew and know that Matthew is preaching entirely to a Jewish audience. All the Gospels have a different vantage point, and thus the birth narrative is different. Matthew is preaching to an entirely Jewish audience. His book is actually a very Jewish book. If you look at the literary format, it's broken up into five parts, resembling Torah. So a Jewish audience would go, oh, this makes sense to me. He even takes the birth story, not back to Bethlehem, but back to Abraham, so that those original Jews, that first audience would go, oh, aha, this is a Jewish birth narrative. So that audience is leaning in going, this sounds Jewish to us. But then he blows their hard drives because he weaves women into the birth narrative of Jesus, and that's not Jewish at all. As a matter of fact, that breaks every Jewish protocol, because in Judaism, when you talked about genealogy, the mamas are never, ever, ever included. Even though those Old Testament girls had their babies without ice chips or epidurals, they are never, ever included in genealogies. It was just considered tacky. It was like in the South, if you used to wear white pants after Labor Day, that just wasn't done. You know, your mama would go, honey, that's just trashy. My mama told me I was not allowed to wear nude pantyhose to church because that was trashy. Well, in Jewish history, you did not include women in genealogies. So Matthew has got them at the beginning of this sermon. And then you can almost sense, if you understand Jewish culture, them going, wait a second. What in the world is he doing? He has woven women into the genealogy. This is just trashy. And y'all, it's not just the fact that he wove women in the genealogy, but it's the kind of women he wove into the genealogy. You've got Tamar is the first one. And y'all probably remember David's daughter, Tamar. There's two infamous Tamars in the Old Testament. This is actually not David's daughter. This is Judah's daughter-in-law. Do y'all remember who Judah was? He was one of the original 12 tribes, the leader of the tribe of Judah. He was a big dog. I mean, he was a big dog. You know, drove a beamer, lived in a gated community. And his eldest son, his name was something with an O. Anyway, his eldest son, and that's a big deal if you're a big dog, your eldest son's wedding. Y'all have seen him in Belmead. I mean, it's a big deal. He marries this chick named Tamar. Well, then Judah's eldest son is a stinker. And so do you remember what God did to his eldest son? Y'all can talk back. It's not Sunday morning. Do you remember what he did? Fried him into a grease spot because he was so unfaithful. So then Tamar is left a widow. Judah's eldest son is dead. And so do you remember who she married next, according to this Old Testament culture? It's a Levirate marriage. She married Judah's second son, who also was a rat fink. And so after a while, God fried him. Well, then Tamar starts thinking, this doesn't bode well for me. And this is in Genesis 38, if you want to check my biblical facts. This doesn't bode well for me because two of Judah's boys have already died while married to me. So according to Levirate marriage, I should marry Shelah, the third and last son of Judah. But I bet you a nickel Judah tries to kind of change the commitment, which in fact he did. Judah says, hey, Tamar, I know technically you're supposed to marry Shelah, my third son, but you know, he hasn't gone through puberty yet. And so if you'll just go back to your people, when he does, I'll text you and we can plan the wedding. I'm taking the tiniest bit of liberty with the Hebrew, but this is almost exactly what happened. And so they separate and Tamar starts thinking, I better what? Because we do the same thing. I better take matters into my own hands. I mean, I better take care of myself because I just get the sense that Judah is no longer going to take care of me. So do y'all remember what she did? It's spicy. When people tell me the Bible's boring, I'm like, you're reading the wrong book. I mean, this is more colorful than Jerry Springer. Do you remember what she did? She got a facelift and disguised herself as a prostitute and then got jiggy with her father-in-law, with Judah. Judah and Tamar skip movie and dinner and just get right to the intimate part. And she gets pregnant. Now, I know we try not to do this at Grace Chapel, but in Tamar's circles, all those women disguise gossip as prayer requests. And so they came together and they were like, can you believe it? Can you believe it? And then one of those yahoos went to Judah and tattled. And she said, Judah, remember your daughter-in-law? I mean, she was like your daughter-in-law twice, and now she's promised to Shelah, your baby boy, who has kind of a non-gender name. Well, she has gone out, and she has gotten herself pregnant.
And she's not just a little bit pregnant either. She's like huge pregnant. Do y'all remember this? And Judas says, well, I hate this, but we're going to have to kill her. Y'all remember this? And so he sends a text and says, it's time for you to come back, Tamar. Tamar comes and stands in front of her former father-in-law. And he says, baby, it's good to see you again, but I'm so sorry. We're going to have to kill you. And she says, not so fast, Big Daddy. These babies are yours. Y'all remember the audience Matt is preaching to. He is preaching to a Jewish audience who has been taught you have to be perfect. You have to perfectly abide by 613 Torah laws or you don't get to be in God's family. You better do it right. And Matthew says, let me tell you about God's son. The first woman in his genealogy had an affair with her father-in-law. Don't you know somebody in that audience went, ooh, yikers. Ooh, yikers. And he says, now the next girl, Rahab, she didn't have to disguise herself. She was a card-carrying member of the Ladies of the Evening Club. You know, they're now starting to just panic as he goes on with this sermon. He says, so you've got Tamar. You've got Rahab, who was a lady of the evening. He says, and then you have Ruth. And some of y'all are thinking, well, Ruth was a good girl. What in the world is Lisa going to say about Ruth? Well, I want you to pretend like you're Jewish. Because we talk about Ruth now in 21st century evangelical culture, and we're like, oh, she was so nice. You know, she's the one whose mother-in-law was really grumpy. Remember her mother-in-law? Remember she said, now that my husband is dead and my two sons are dead, I'm going back to the little town Bethlehem that we grew up in. I'm tired of living in this huge Moab. These people are hateful. These girls wear short skirts. I want to go home. Remember? Yep. And so Ruth says, I'm going to follow you back home. Do y'all remember what her mother-in-law's name is? Naomi. Do you remember Naomi's nickname? Mara, don't even call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara, bitter, because I'm ticked off at the trajectory of my life. I didn't want to lose my boys. I didn't want to lose my husband. I want to go back home. I know the women there. I was in creative memories with them and Weight Watchers with them. I want to go home. I'm sick of Moab. I'm sick of all these pagans. And so both of her daughter-in-laws, one is named Orpah. Now, this is just a fun little did you know fact, but do you know that Oprah's daddy was trying to name her Orpah and misspelled it, which I just think is a hoot. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Anyway, you've got Orpah and you've got Ruth. Those are her two daughter-in-laws who are Moabite women. And they go, we'll go with you back to Bethlehem from Moabite territory. And Naomi says, no, y'all really don't go back to Bethlehem with me. It's a tiny little town. There's not even a stoplight, no Starbucks. Y'all are not going to get married if you go back to Bethlehem. And so Orpah goes, cool, I was hoping you'd say that. But Ruth says, Mama, I'm with you. Wherever you go, I'm going. Your people will be my people. Your God, capital G, in Ruth chapter 1, that means that was her profession of faith. She was saying, your God, capital G, Yahweh Jehovah, is my God. So she's saying, I don't believe in the God of Moab anymore. I'm following you and I'm following your God. And so I'm going with you. So Ruth follows Naomi. They go back to this two-bit town. They're really, really poor because both of them are widows. They didn't really have the kind of social services we have. It was incumbent upon the church, the synagogue, to give money to widows. So they're so impoverished. They're living in a government-subsidized apartment. Naomi sits there in a lazy boy with duct tape on the arms, and Ruth says, I'm going to go see if I can scrounge up some food. She goes and she gleans grain behind Hebrew tractors. Y'all remember the story, except for the John Deere part? She gleans grain behind the tractors, and one day while she's gleaning grain, the most eligible bachelor of Bethlehem, do y'all remember his name? Boaz. Boaz comes back from a business trip. He sees Ruth in his field in the position of a slave, because the slaves were the ones who gleaned grain. And he turns to his foreman, and y'all remember what he asked his foreman? Whose young woman is that? Do you know what that's translated from in Hebrew? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Or close. It's really, really close. He saw her and he was like, she is beautiful. I have not seen her before. And if you know the rest of that story, they fall in love. Boaz becomes her kinsman redeemer. They get married. And at the end of the book of Ruth, you see that she has a son. His name is Obed. And 29 generations later, 29 generations from Obed, another baby boy is born, also in Bethlehem, probably in a cave at the edge of a field that his great, 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 and then some grandmama gleaned grain in, and his name is Jesus. So that's why Ruth is in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, and that's why evangelicals go, oh, God is so faithful. But Jewish people in the first century would not have seen that redemptive part of her story. Jewish people would have gotten stuck on the fact that she was a Moabite. So her family history is horrific according to a Jew's understanding. Do y'all remember where the name Moabite came from? You've got to go all the way back to Genesis 19. Do you remember the city in Genesis 19? We've talked about it a lot last couple of years, because a lot of people are comparing America to this city, Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember there was one good guy in Sodom and Gomorrah, one promise keeper. Do y'all remember his name? Lot. And do you remember God, and actually it wasn't even Lot that was faithful. Lot's faithfulness was based on Abraham. But God said, because of Abraham's faithfulness in your lineage, Lot, I'm gonna spare you and your wife and your two daughters, when I pour out my wrath on Sodom and Gomorrah. This city is so wicked. I'm going to pour out my wrath. I'm not going to spare anybody but your family. But here's the deal, Lot. When I let you and Mrs. Lot and your two girls escape to the high country, there is one condition. Do y'all remember the condition? Don't look back. Whatever you do when you are leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, don't look back. So Lot, Mrs. Lot, and their two daughters, who most Old Testament historians think were teenagers, they turn and they sprint out of Sodom and Gomorrah right before God pours out his wrath. Do you remember what happens when they're sprinting out of town to the high country, we're told? Yeah, Mrs. Lot looks back. Now, this is not in the Bible. This is in my imagination. In my imagination, she has just hounded Mr. Lot to death for a kitchen remodel. And he finally let her go to Lowe's and take out a credit card. And they've finally gotten granite and stainless steel. And so when she's sprinting out of town, she's like, I don't want to leave my kitchen. And she turns around. And when she does, sa-zoom, God just strikes her. And what does she become? Pillar salt. So she's the first scary spice. It's not the English chick who sings. It's Mrs. Lot. She's just frozen there on the outskirts of Sodom and Gomorrah. So it's only Lot and his two daughters who make it to the high country, who make the escape. Do you remember what happens next? This is all in Genesis 19. One of those daughters turns to the other daughter and says, this is a bummer. I mean, there's no social life here. There's not only no mall and no Starbucks, there are no men. So you and I are going to be like Lisa Harper. We're going to be old maids. Like, this is just sad. And the other one goes, no, I have an idea. How about you and I go to 7-Eleven and we get some Boone's Farm and we get Daddy drunk. And when Daddy's really, really drunk and inebriated, you and I can both be physically intimate with our very own Daddy. And then we can get pregnant. We can have babies and we start our own little daycare up here. It'll be so much fun. Now, y'all, again, tiniest bit of liberty with the Hebrew. That is what happened. Both of those daughters got their father, Lot, inebriated. Both daughters on successive evenings were physically intimate with their daddy. Both girls got pregnant. The oldest daughter, both had sons, but the oldest daughter had a son and named him Moab. Do you know what the name Moab means in English? Daddy's boy or from father. So God himself in the book of Deuteronomy says, no Moabites are allowed in my house. That was when it was a transient temple. It was the tent of meeting. And he said, no Moabite up to five generations back is allowed in the tent of meeting. I don't want a Moabite coming before me in worship because their tribe started out in incest. That's an unfaithful people group. So if you're a first century Jew and you're hearing Matthew tell this Christmas story, you're like, I don't want Ruth in the genealogy of God's own son. I mean, she's a Moabitess. Those people are bad, trashy. So you've got Tamar, who was physically intimate with her own father-in-law. You've got Rahab, who is a prostitute. You've got Ruth, who came from way on the other side of the tracks, from Incestville. And then you've got Bathsheba, and Matt won't even name her. He says Solomon's mama, who had been Uriah's wife. You remember Uriah was deployed on the front lines on behalf of God's people, on behalf of Israel, when Bathsheba and David got together. And so she's this infamous adulteress. Y'all remember the audience he's preaching to. He's like, let me tell you a little Christmas story. And everybody leans in. And then he shocks them by saying, it's not about perfection. It's about the character of the Son. And he's perfect. This isn't about you. Our Creator Redeemer wove women who were wildly flawed, a prostitute, an adulteress, a woman whose background includes incest. Those are the women he wove into his son's family tree. He didn't just say, you can come over to our house for Christmas Eve dinner. It wasn't just that God was being kind. God said, these women are in the family tree of my son. Y'all, that Christmas message was so loud and clear to that Jewish audience. You get to be connected with Jehovah. This isn't about you keeping all the rules. This is about you recognizing, I can't keep all the rules. And so God made a way for me. My God is so big. He's so kind. He's so merciful. Christmas epitomizes grace. Y'all, if Christians really got Christmas, we would get our kids metaphorical ponies every day. Because this is our story every day. Every day it's not about us. It's about the goodness of the God who loves us and calls us his. On my worst day, God says, that one's mine. Isn't she beautiful, even when I'm in elastic waistbands? That one's mine. I love her. A friend of mine, a couple of years ago, I went over to her house, and it was like December 29th, and she still had her tree up, and there was this exquisitely wrapped gift under her tree. And I thought, well, that's odd, because, you know, Christmas has already come and gone, and she's got this beautiful gift wrapped under her tree. It wasn't like a re-gifter Bath and Body Works lotion. I mean, this was gorgeous. And I was like, oh, do you have family still coming in town? Because I assumed that was for something special. And she said, no, every year I purposely have one gift that is a really elegant, expensive gift, because inevitably a neighbor or someone I don't know that well will come over and they'll be kind of embarrassed because they forgot to bring me fruitcake or, you know, a $5 Starbucks card. And she said, I want to give them something that says I've been waiting for you. I want to give them something really, really special. So I try to have one gift that's a really, really special gift and give it to one person who doesn't think they deserve it. And this next part of Matthew 1, I feel like is that exact thing from Father God for us for Christmas. There's this gift in Matthew chapter 1, in this birth narrative, that I think so few people ever unwrap. It's in verse 17, after this beautiful gift that says you don't have to be perfect to be in relationship with God the Father. It's not about you, it's about Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us. He gives us this second exquisite gift. Verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to Christ, 14 generations. Stay right there, but I want you to listen loud to Allison read this verse from Leviticus 25, verse 17. This is Leviticus 25, verse 17. Remember, the audience is Jewish.
Do not take advantage of each other, but fear your God. I am the Lord your God.
I think I gave you the wrong verse.
Here's the Jubilee down here. But
Yeah. I gave you the wrong verse.
You want me to do some of this?
So, yeah. But let me see it. Hang on. I know that wasn't as powerful as we planned.
Are you getting this Tony Bird song?
Must have been 27. It's 27. I have 17. It's 27.
One?
Yeah. Yeah, wait. Go from 18. It must have started at 7. Go from 18 through to 28.
All right. Here we go, y'all. Leviticus 25:18. Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. You may ask, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in. The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants. Throughout the land that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what the countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the 3 years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. Then he can go back to his own property.
And you shall count, that was the wrong chapter two. You shall count 7 weeks of 7 years. Seven times 7 years. This begins in verse 8. So I was only off 11 verses. 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you when each of you shall return to his property and each of you shall return to his clan. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. What they were saying in the law was, you know, every seventh year, the land was fallow. They didn't plow, they didn't sow, they didn't reap. And that seventh year, that was a year of rest, a year of rest. Basically, it was the same template God gave us in creation. Well, what the law tells us, this Mosaic law in Leviticus chapter 25, is on the seventh seven, so the 49th year, from 49 to 50, that's your 50th year, that seventh seven is the jubilee. That's like the super rest. That's all debt is forgiven. So no matter how high your target card balance is, it's forgiven. All captives, regardless of how heinous the crime, are set free from prison. And you will be blessed. It's the jubilee. It's the 50th year. Now, most of us read over those verses in Matthew chapter 1 and we go, oh, all this genealogy stuff drives me nuts. We can understand when Allison pulls out a wreath and gives us the symbolism of the Advent wreath. We go, oh, I get it. And that's more of a Western culture symbol. If we were Jewish women living in the first century, our symbols would be numerology. And so that's what Matthew did in this Christmas story. He said, let me tell you about Jesus. There were crazy girls who didn't have it all together in his genealogy. That means you don't have to fulfill all 613 Torah laws. You don't have to be perfect to be in relationship with God the Father. Perfection is not a prerequisite. And let me give you another gift. There's 14 generations from Abraham to David. There's 14 generations from David to Babylon. And then there's 14 generations from Babylon to Jesus. Now, let me give you kind of an FYI here. Matthew actually does some funky math, because if you go back to the Old Testament and you actually count up the generations, he actually kind of plays fuzzy with the math here, because one of them was like 13. I think the other was 16. So he's making a point. He's making a strong point on 14, Jesus. Do you hear what he's saying? Do you see the gift we hardly ever unwrap? Jesus is the seventh seven. That's what he's saying to this audience. Jesus is the rest. Jesus sets captives free. Jesus forgives your debt. In Jesus, you don't ever have to be bound again. Jesus is our jubilee. He's our seventh seven. When I was in my 20s, my sister and I decided we were going to drive to Florida for Christmas together. Neither one of us were married at that time. I lived in Nashville. She lived in Birmingham. And so we decided we were going to drive to Florida. My parents divorced when I was a little bitty girl and had a very, very ugly divorce. And normally when we went home for Christmas, we went to Mama's house, because Mama's house was where the tree was. Mama's house was where our traditions were. Daddy was very, very, very gruff and was not much of a celebratory man. So we would go see Daddy on Christmas afternoon, and Christmas night he would take us to Denny's for pie, which mortified my sister, who even then was trying to be elegant. We decided just, and this is before cell phones, so for those of y'all under 40, I grew up when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, but this is before we even had cell phones. We would call our parents, you know, on a landline and say, we're coming home. And then 9 hours later, we would get there. Well, on the trip, we decided, you know what? We should go by Daddy's first. We've never done that before. We always go to Mom's, and Dad really needs cheering up. He's just kind of always Eeyore, you know, he's kind of always grumpy. And so let's take our presents to Dad's first and go out and find some Charlie Brown Christmas tree and help Dad get into Christmas this year. So we stopped part of the way home and we called my dad. And we just said, Daddy, we've decided we're going to come to your house first. And instead of going to Mom's, we're going to come to your house first. And I don't remember what he said. He usually was very monosyllabic, and he'd be like, girls, drive careful. I mean, he just was real, very grumpy. And so I was like, well, let's go to Dad's. So 5 hours later, we pull into my dad's neighborhood. He lived in a very modest neighborhood. And there's cars lining the street that goes to his house. And my dad lived 3 houses down from the police station. So I thought, I bet they're having a Christmas. This was Christmas Eve. And I said, I bet they're having a Christmas celebration at the police station or something for underprivileged kids or something. And my sister was like, well, I don't even know how we can get to Dad's house. Like, the whole street is almost blocked off with all these cars. And so we're trying to weave our way through all these cars. Well, as we get closer to Dad's house, we realize we can't even park at Dad's house. He didn't have a garage or anything, just a kind of dirt driveway beside his house. But she was like, at least we can't even get to Dad's house. There's so many people. And I was like, well, let's just park over here on the side of the road where these other cars are, and we'll walk to Dad's. Obviously, they're doing something at the police station. And then both of us started noticing people aren't walking toward the police station. They're walking toward where Dad's house is. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I don't even know a house down there big enough, you know, to accommodate all these people. This is just interesting. And I thought maybe, you know, they have one of those trashy community centers that we didn't know was in Dad's very, very modest neighborhood that I've never seen. Maybe there's a pool. And so we start walking toward Dad's house, and then we start noticing, you know, it looks like people are turning into Dad's house. And then we start noticing there is smoke coming out of my father's yard. And I thought, oh crud, these are all volunteer firemen. Like, my dad's house is on fire, except they're carrying casseroles. And we walk into my dad's front yard, and y'all, there are 150 people at my dad's house. And when my sister and I walked into the yard, everybody started clapping.
And my dad said, my girls are here. I told y'all my girls were coming home for Christmas. And I cannot tell you how many people came up to us and said, we thought y'all were little. Because your dad kept talking about my girls. For the first time, my girls are coming home. We thought y'all were like 7 and 8. We thought somebody was going to drop y'all off. And my dad just, he couldn't speak. He had rented one of those things from Home Depot. We were like, how did you do this in 5 hours? My dad called all the guys who worked for his construction company. And he said, I'm pulling y'all off the jobs. I want somebody to go get a grill. I want somebody to go get ribs. I want y'all to call everybody from church. My girls are coming home. My girls are coming home. It is still the sweetest Christmas memory I've ever had, is my grumpy daddy getting that excited about my sister and I driving to his house first. Y'all, that is the Father's love for us. I feel like he's going, do you get it? Do you get it? Jesus is your Jubilee. Jesus is your Jubilee. Y'all, you get set free. Do you get it? Do you get it? My girls are coming home. Y'all, that's our Christmas. We should be going to Disney every day, y'all. Every day we should wake up like my Missy does, and she goes, is it time for Disney yet, Mama? Are we going to Disney? How many weeks is it time for? She is so excited about Christmas. I believe by the time she's 11 or 12, she'll go, are we celebrating Jesus yet? Or are we celebrating Jesus yet? Because she's starting to put the two together. We're big girls. We know what the present is this Christmas. I want to open the altar. We've got just a few minutes. And Faithy, whatever God leads you to sing. But my gut says some of you do not have the peace that God died to bring us this Christmas. It's perfect peace, y'all. Perfect peace. You don't have to be in bondage anymore. He says, I came to get rid of that. You're not captives anymore. You're my family. On your worst day, you're in my lineage. Some of y'all have anxiety, not just because of what's going to happen with our country and the election and your friends who may have voted a different way than you voted. Some of you are anxious because your mother-in-law's coming for Thanksgiving. And that's been hard in the past for you because she always treats you like her son could have done better. Some of y'all are anxious because you aren't sure if your kids are coming back home for Christmas because you've got a prodigal in your family. Some of you can't even wrap words around why Christmas is painful for you, but you know the statistics and you know that suicide doubles during Christmas time. If there is anxiety in your spirit, if you are not settled in peace as we approach Thanksgiving, would you approach the altar this morning and just say, Jesus, help me unwrap you as my Jubilee. Help me get that you're my perfect rest.